Hello everyone, and welcome to the File Room Podcast, a podcast about the X-Files.
That is also a desperate attempt to reconnect a friendship across the Atlantic.
I'm Edwin Davis.
And I'm Michaela Livingston Banks.
If you're new to the X-Files or watching it for the 10th time, watch along with us while we explore the dark corners of the American psyche.
Via a TV show from the 90s.
So, Michaela, how has your week been? Did you have a nice leap day since we're recording this the week of leap day?
Oh, which day was leap day?
Thursday.
Thursday. Yes. I went on a big old long drive to Plymouth and back again. So it feels like a time warp of a day that never happened. Yes, I had a very good week. Busy week, work and life stuff. It's been a bit manic, so I'm incredibly tired, which I'm sure is not going to come across at all in recording this. We put our house on the market this week, so if anyone's looking for somewhere to live in Oxford, you know, we've got just the place. Give us all your money. So getting that already has been quite a thing. Yeah, clearing the house so it doesn't look like a complete and utter pigsty. Not that it usually does, but you know how it is when in photos. I do it myself. I'm always judging photos of other people's houses on Rightmove and things. And so I just didn't want there to be those other people doing that to our house. How about you? How's the week been going? What did you do with your leap day?
So with my leap day, I decided to listen to the Libertines for the first time in a long time, because this leap day was exactly 20 years to the day since I saw the Libertines live at the O2 Academy in Birmingham with my sister. Which is I think of as my first real concert, because it was like the first time I actually went to see a band that I wanted to see live, as opposed to like the various jazz and folk bands that would play in my parents' pub, who I would kind of occasionally see live just to kind of like see what they were doing, but usually just hear through the floorboards of the flat. Or like gigs that they would take me and my sister to. So that was the first one the way I went to. It's like, oh, I want to go and this is a band whose music I like and I want to see live. And I have very fond memories of.
Yeah.
At least partly because, for people who are unfamiliar with the Libertines, they were a short-lived but very much beloved indie band from England in the sort of early 2000s, who were most famous at the time as being sort of tabloid fodder for one of their frontmen, Pete Doherty, who was constantly being kicked in and out of the band.
Mm.
And we got to see them during the very brief window when he rejoined the band in order to record their second album and go on that tour, and before he was then kicked out, I think permanently, because I think after that they broke up not too soon afterwards, if I remember the chronology. So that was a nice dose of nostalgia.
Yeah.
It did leave me thinking about like how so many of their songs just seem to end up being used as like incidental music in like British teen dramas or something of the time, because like that kind of like slightly fuzzy guitar sound always seemed to be like, oh, people are arriving at the pub or whatever. Like, I'm fairly sure it was used in the Inbetweeners more than one occasion.
Oh, I can believe that, yeah. It's like generic noughties in British indie.
Yeah, so that was one of those things. Well, on the one hand, I have all these like really fond memories of going to that gig, but also like when I would go to Fuzz Club, like Libertine songs would always be things that would really kind of like set off the dance floor, and in particular the song Time for Heroes, where I have very clear memories of like just screaming I'll cherish you, my love, in the face of all my male friends, which is the most homoerotic moment I think of my life. Just everyone being like extremely sweaty and singing words of devotion to each other.
Did you never get involved with the topless wrestling fights that seem to break out in every house party between the blokes? Like that seems to be my abiding memory of house parties at uni. For some reason, all the blokes would strip down and wrestle one another in the living room.
I mean, I do remember that happening once when we were staying at Paul, our previously mentioned friend's Paul's flat, where it was him and our friend Aaron, who just had a baby. They ended up wrestling shirtless on the floor there. I myself never got involved in those, but it's good that both of them have now brought life into the world.
They are brilliant fathers, should just say. But yes,
I'm sure.
All of the guys I can think of who were involved in these very common topless wrestling fights at parties, they are all now fathers, apart from John,
who's a terrible father
with his non-existent child. Yeah,
but also you were just mentioning there about like trying to make the house look nice, you know, for you putting it on the market. Just reminded me of the time when, after we were at uni together and we were all living in a house, and one of our housemates moved out and our landlord kept bringing people around to try and look around the place, and none of those people seemed keen on becoming our housemates, because it seemed like the place was looked like a war zone.
It did.
And was just like a terrible mess, until my friend Patrick decided to move in, because he really needed somewhere to stay and we had a spare room, so it all worked out.
Yes, we weren't good at the communal washing up or cleaning situation. Funnily enough, I feel like we each kept our own rooms really clean, but the communal situation was just like the bystander effect, because it was like everyone and no one was responsible. I have a very clear memory of one day, I think it might have been after one of my birthdays, waking up the next day and going around with a black bin bag to pick up all the bottles and cans, and I swear to God that like just every inch of the floor space was nothing but cans and bottles. And like there were quite a few people who came around for that party. I think that was the Heroes and Villains costume party. But despite now thinking about even that number of people drinking that amount of stuff, it's just like, no way. So I think clearly my memory is a bit off, but that is my memory.
Well, I think also we would encourage people to bring their own beers, so I think that probably also contributed to it a lot.
Oh, sure. I certainly just the drinking, the consuming of that much alcohol just seems wild to me now. Wild.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I don't doubt your memory. I'm pretty sure in my memory there was definitely a lot of drinking at those parties, and I certainly remember on occasions being like, oh, you know, I'll put stuff in the bin bag and I'll like take it down to the recycling or whatever, and just walking all along Ecky Road with just like two bin bags full of bottles and cans to take down to I think Waitrose, that was might have been the nearest place that had recycling. So like
the other walk of shame for, like,
yeah, for, like, so that was like a 2 mile walk just carrying those fun times.
Wow, I
wonder how other people must have thought of just walking down with like tons of bottles. It's like that guy's got a problem, but he is very conscientious, so it all works out. But anyway, enough of reminiscing about the past. Let's talk about something else from the past, an episode of The X-Files. This week we're going to be talking about the episode Fire. Michaela, why don't you give us a synopsis of Fire?
Sure thing. So, in the opening scene, a wealthy man spontaneously combusts outside his rural home. Meanwhile, back in America, Mulder and Scully are approached by Phoebe Green, a British inspector and Mulder's former love interest, with a case of mysterious fire-related deaths, including the spontaneous combustion incident from the opening scene. Another potential victim, Sir Malcolm Marsden, has narrowly escaped a fiery death and is seeking a break and safety in America, moving into a vacation home where the culprit, Cecil Lively, acting as Bob, has killed and taken the place of the caretaker. We come to see that Lively, who appeared in the opening scene, possesses pyrokinetic abilities, allowing him to start fires with his mind, aided by rocket fuel. Lively decides to visit a bar and ends up leaving survivors who provide a description for a composite sketch. While Mulder is distracted by Phoebe, Scully advances the investigation, and the situation escalates in a Boston hotel where Scully discovers Mulder and Phoebe in an intimate moment, let's call it that, just as a fire erupts in the hotel. Despite Mulder's fear of fire, which he revealed earlier to Scully, he attempts a rescue of the Marsden's children, but is overwhelmed by the smoke. Lively, mistaken for the family's driver and masquerading as a hero, gets praised for, quote-unquote, saving the children. The next day, Mulder and Scully are discussing what Scully found out. Now aware of Lively's identity and their suspicion of his role as the murderer, they rush to the Marsden's house, where the family identify Lively as the caretaker, not the driver, from the composite sketch. In a dramatic confrontation with, you guessed it, more fire, Mulder gets another chance at playing hero and saves children this time. And they expose Lively, who is then engulfed in flames after having been doused with his own rocket fuel by Phoebe. The episode ends with Lively, severely burnt, recovering in a secure medical facility confined in a hyperbaric chamber. There you go, Ed.
Mm.
Let's get going. Yeah. Let's get this fire going. Started, party started, whatever. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is a really fun one. Yeah, it's a Monster of the Week episode, so obviously like not really connected to anything. And I think they do a good job on the whole monster side of things. The idea of someone who is has pyrokinetic powers is like a fun one. Obviously, there's lots of examples of this in fiction. Firestarter by Stephen King probably being the most famous one, and probably something of an influence on this episode, I would imagine.
Mm.
But the thing that really makes it work is I think they picked a really great guy to play Cecil / Bob, which is Mark Shepard, mm-hmm. who is an actor who I mainly think of for two other roles of his. One, Badger in Firefly, where he's kind of like the kind of dodgy dealer mm-hmm. sort of guy that they consult at various points. And as Romo Lampkin in the later seasons of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, yeah.
And in all of those, he has a kind of charismatic danger to him where, you know, you can't help but kind of like him, even though he's obviously not someone that you can trust.
Yeah.
And I think you see a little bit of that here in this, where obviously from the opening scene, you know, oh yeah, this guy doesn't seem to be a good person. But every time he is like talking to people and, you know, charming them as, you know, when he's pretending to be Bob or when he's like flirting with the woman in the bar that he then immediately sets on fire, you know, he has like a real charm to him.
Yeah.
And I think that makes him really, really compelling, even though he is also like a real creep.
Yeah. I mean, he is that kind of wheeler dealer del boy kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say, he's really charismatic. So yeah, you can't help but like him. Little cheeky smirk when he's watching people go up in flames.
And the other thing that he does in is like their actual driver of the rich family, he gets like increasingly ill over the course of the episode, and it's not initially clear why that is, and then like towards the end you realize, oh, it's because Cecil's been secretly giving him rocket fuel so that he is becoming sicker and sicker, and eventually he can set him on fire, which is how he kills all of his victims.
Yeah.
He kind of gets rocket fuel either on or in them and then ignites it using his mind. There is like a real impish fun to him when you can tell, oh, something he is doing is responsible for why this guy is getting increasingly sick.
Yeah.
But we don't know initially what might be causing it. And obviously you don't want him to succeed. I mean, this kind of gets in, I think, a little bit into what we were talking about with Eve, where, like, on the one hand, you don't want the villain of the episode to succeed because they're going to do, and they have done, awful things.
Yeah.
But on the other side, you're kind of like, there's something quite charming about them. If there was some way for this guy to get redeemed, I wouldn't be mad.
Yeah. That was funny that they do... I mean, well, maybe it's a real-life thing because a lot of... psychopaths and sociopaths are quite affable characters, aren't they? And they manage to get people to like them. So maybe that's on purpose, or maybe it's just more fun to write sinister characters that way, whilst they're going
yeah.
about in society trying not to be the complete monsters that they are. Talking of like the rocket fuel thing, watching it the second time round, I did find it really funny that when Cecil's painting the house, first time round it's just like, oh, he's doing caretaker work, he's just painting. Second time round, you know, like they've just gone from talking to the arson specialist to then that scene, and it focuses on the paint tin for just a couple seconds, and it literally says rocket propulsion on it. Which you definitely, they make a point of showing later on in the episode, when they're like, oh, that's how he did it. But there's this whole discussion of like, where's the accelerant or whatever coming from that means that these things are, and people are burning so so fast and so hot that it doesn't leave any evidence behind. But yeah, literally says rocket propulsion on it.
Mm-hmm.
Not subtle, but a lot of fun. Because the fire in this episode, the fire effects are, for the most part, almost all of them are flipping great. I love a bit of fire. I used to watch London's Burning.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah, and like, obviously it's scary and everything, but like, there's something really mesmerizing and spectacular about fire. I mean, you know, who doesn't like watching a fire in a fireplace or a fire pit or whatever?
Yeah,
it's just really spectacular. And as well, the fire stunts with the people burning or bits of people burning are just... You kind of know how these things work. You know, they cover the people in gel and fire suits and all this kind of thing and then set them on fire. And that's not to say they're not without danger anyway. But they just look horrific, but awesome.
Yeah. In particular, I really like when Cecil goes to the bar and he's talking to the woman and then he offers to light a cigarette and then like he makes a tiny flame appear at the end of his finger. And then when she turns around to say to her friends, hey, look at this trick. And then he comes back and then he's holding up and his entire hand is engulfed in flames, which he then like swipes across the bar to kind of like set all of the alcohol on it on fire. That's just like, it's such a simple gag, but it works really, really well. And it does look like genuinely quite terrifying.
Yeah, and they didn't use any CGI in this episode, so like because you know you're watching and he wags his finger side to side and the flame just follows and but yeah, like there he must have just had an actual bit of fire like gel or something on his finger. Mark Shepherd, I think, did almost all of the stunts himself other than I think the full body burn at the end. But that's scary. Like, I don't know if I'd want to do that, even if there are 60 people with fire extinguishers standing around me.
Yeah, it always seems like one of those things where you think, God, I bet that would be really cool. But also, the mental calculus you have to do on whether or not it's worth the risk is pretty high.
Yeah.
The other fire effect I thought was really good is when, I think it's in the hotel fire, when Mulder kind of like falls down and then there's flames just like roiling across the ceiling and it looks like genuinely hellish and like nightmarish. It's a really great looking episode in general, but the way they shoot fire in this, I think, is really cool and beautiful, but also gets across the danger of it because obviously fire is dangerous and also you are meant to, I think, in that moment, really be put inside Mulder's head as someone who apparently has a deathly fear of fire that has never come up prior to this.
And will never come up again. Yeah. Apparently that was Chris Carter's actual fear. So the story that Mulder tells to Scully.
Something else I haven't told you about myself, Scully. I hate fire. Hate it. I'm scared to death of it. When I was a kid, my best friend's house burned down. I had to spend the night in the rubble, keep away looters. For years, I had nightmares about being trapped in a burning building.
Apparently, that actually happened to Chris Carter. So, Chris Carter's life experience has become a temporary? No, I mean, it comes up just the once, but I mean, it's a bit odd because isn't everyone afraid of fire?
Yeah, that's, I think, that is the only kind of like bum note in the episode for me, which otherwise I think is really fine. They establish, they decide for this one episode that he has this deathly fear of fire, and then it's resolved by the end of the episode, which kind of feels a little cheap. But also, I'm sure there are people who are like abnormally afraid of fire, who like, they maybe couldn't even be in the same room as a birthday cake or something. Like, I'm sure that is definitely a thing happens for some people. But Mulder's fear of fire as it pertains to this episode actually doesn't seem that different from a normal person's fear of fire. Like, if I was in a burning hotel corridor and running to get some kids, I think I would probably be overwhelmed, and I don't have an especially keen fear of fire. I think it would be like a very difficult thing to try and steel yourself up to do.
Well, I think the only way it really matters or is relevant in the episode is the fact that he seems to hesitate for a second or so before going onto the floor to go get the kids. And I suppose it's like, oh, isn't he so brave that despite the fact that he's scared, he's going to go do this anyway? I mean, he ultimately fails, but because smoke inhalation is bad. But even so, I think anyone would pause for a second before they run into a burning building. If
in nothing
at all.
But an evening suit.
Well, yeah. So, like, yeah, it just seems kind of irrelevant, I guess, because as well, you don't really see any more build up to it. I guess you feel a little sad for him. I guess it's texture and makes him feel a little more real. And then you're happy for him at the end of the episode when he gets to play hero again and actually does manage to save the kids. But it's a bit of an odd touch. I'm not mad about it.
No, it's I think we've kind of like talked about this in previous episodes. It's the sort of detail where if the rest of the episode wasn't any good, like, it'd be easy to fixate on it. But because I think the rest of the episode is really strong, it's just one of those things where you think, I wish this thing was handled a little bit better and was, like, maybe a little obvious as essentially a thing to say, oh, we kind of need to give more some extra wrinkle in this episode. Mm-hmm. The other kind of, like, big character, obviously, we talked about Cecil. The other kind of really big character in this episode is, as you mentioned in the synopsis, Phoebe Green, mm-hmm. Who's played by Amanda Pays, who previously to this, I think, had been the co-lead of the Flash TV series that aired in the early 90s, mm-hmm. Which I watched, but I don't think anyone else did.
I did not.
But it was back in the days when there was a dearth of superhero media, if you can imagine such a thing. So,
no, I can't imagine such a thing. It's like ubiquitous now.
I was very, very excited as like a six-year-old to watch that when Sky One started showing it. But I imagine by that point it had already been cancelled because it was a notorious failure.
Oh.
Although she did then reprise the character in the more recent Flash TV series, because like that one, there's like different timelines and stuff. So they brought back a lot of the old actors from the previous show, which was a nice touch. But I really like her in this episode. She's very fun. She's very good at playing slightly saucy, posh person, essentially. Yeah. Like where she really seems to delight in how much she knocks Mulder off kilter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she's very good at kind of like flirting with him and just kind of generally toying with his affections in ways that don't feel like malicious. It just more feels like, yeah, she's having a bit of fun with this guy she used to know. And then also the flip side of that that's really funny is like so many good eye rolls from Scully in this episode.
Love
she's
it.
Kind of like, oh God, what's he doing now?
Yeah, the best is obviously when she walks in on them in the hotel. Because she's coming to tell Mulder about like all this work she's done. And so she's busy doing all this work, but Mulder's just busy flirting around with Phoebe. It's really funny because when after I'd watched this first time round, I was like, oh, okay, so this episode is about sexual frustration then. Because like they sort of talk about what motivates Cecil Lively in terms of his profile and why he does what he does. And it's all because he fancies the wives of these rich people and he can't have them. So he's driven to killing them by setting them on fire. You've got the arson specialist who seems to be in love with fire in a slightly uncomfortable way.
Beautiful. Oh, just beautiful. Look at that. Salmon red flames. This is 1400, 1500 degrees. This is a work of art.
And then obviously you've got the situation with Mulder essentially playing with fire in terms of his relationship with Phoebe. And she's horny as all hell because she's always like, you know, there's always some reference of like doing whatever it is they did. Our imaginations can wander, but, you know, on Arthur Conan Doyle's grave.
And don't you tell me that you've forgotten a certain youthful indiscretion atop Arthur Conan Doyle's tombstone on a misty night in Wintlesham.
Like I said, just stick to
and telling him that, you know, She'll have a hotel room, and like, you know, some of the lines as well, like in the beginning where Scully's making fun of Mulder.
Yeah, I noticed how you couldn't drop everything fast enough in order to help her out.
Oh, I was merely extending her a professional courtesy.
Oh, is that what you were extending?
So yeah.
Yeah, I had that line down.
So like, this episode is just about like the horn, I'm going to say. And when what I did read about what Chris Carter was inspired by, or what he was trying to go with, apparently none of this made it through the script edits and things like this. But the original thing was of fire being an analogy for like marriage or something. I've not read the different script versions and stuff to look into this, so I can only assume it's a commitment phobia thing, maybe? I don't know, but I'm really glad. So Chris Carter wrote this one, and all I have to say is I'm very glad that that didn't make it through, because I think that would have just over-fussed and whatever the episode. The other thing is, at the beginning, you know, it's a wealthy bloke who gets killed, and then I think Phoebe mentions, when she's telling them about the cases, about how it's a long line of like aristocrats being murdered by being set on fire. And I was like, oh god, is there gonna be some like rant in this about class or something? Thankfully there wasn't, because but you know with Chris Carter's writing, you kind of expect that there's gonna be some sort of exposition rant trying to make some point, and usually kind of not very well making said point. I feel like they stripped a lot of that out of this.
It's more implied, I guess, because obviously, you know, he takes on these positions of being servants. Obviously he's the caretaker in Boston, or in New Massachusetts area, and then he's one of the gardeners in the opening scene. So like, there is like an implicit thing about class and like being a striver and like wanting things you can't have because of your position in life.
No.
But the episode doesn't say it. And like, yeah, that's definitely to the credit of the script. And, you know, like I'm sure like any revisions that maybe, like, like you say, took out the stuff about fire and marriage and just generally making it a kind of like a subtler part of the overall episode, as opposed to like really vocalizing it in a way that, sometimes when Carter does it, it's like really obvious and strident, and here it's just kind of like, it's just part of the general approach of the episode.
I think Scully's telling Mulder about the list of people working with these families, and there's a lot of them, and there's some line about how she doesn't think they can even tie, or you'd think they can't even tie their own shoelaces. But you know, that's a fun line. So I think this one found the right balance of being like a dumb spectacle and like being a little and being too kind of or trying to be too cerebral, but then actually just missing the mark and being messy, as some other episodes have kind of fallen foul to.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Agent Beatty, who is the arson expert who they talk to. He's another character that I think is a lot of fun, as just kind of part of the general texture of this episode. He's played by an actor called Duncan Fraser. And yeah, every time they go and talk to him and he starts talking about fire, like he has just like such enthusiasm to it, which, like you say, does come across as like a little weird. You know, like he's so into fire and arson and all of these things, and like on the one level, it's his job, obviously he has a passion for it. He is to fire what Fox Mulder is to UFOs, I guess. every time he's on, and he's not on it in the episode much, but every time he's in it, he just finds like a really fun way of getting across this guy's obsession with his work. Which I thought I appreciated, and he definitely kind of like popped in a way that sometimes like the various experts they speak to, usually like it's just like someone who just like shows up and is like, okay, cool, well, we'll move on to the next one. The only other person I can think of that really made an impression like that was the really deadpan nurse they talked to in Shadows, I think, or like the person.
Oh, the pathologist.
Yeah, the pathologist, yeah. Who also, like, it's fun when they get someone there who makes some strong choices with their performance.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Although the other thing I noticed about him is that, like, every time a woman's in the room, he's just kind of, It just feels really sleazy. Like he's talking about, oh, you've got a really good case there, Mulder. But then it's a shot of Phoebe. And Scully comes to speak to him, and it's like the equivalent for that as well. And it's just like, oh God, this guy's gross. But cool. A really good character, like you say. It's made some very good choices.
Yeah. On the old technology front, I quite liked the use of cassette tapes in this episode.
Yeah.
Phoebe is first introduced when Mulder and Scully are getting into the car after a day in court, which also gives the show its first really big funny line, which is...
Oh, forgot what it was like to spend a day in court.
Now that's one of the luxuries to hunting down aliens and genetic mutants. You rarely get to press charges.
Yeah, there was a very funny joke there, and then...
Yeah.
Then they realize that the car is unlocked, and Scully just sarcastically says, oh, must be an X-File, which is...
Yeah.
But then they get in, and then there's a cassette tape sitting on the top, and then they listen to it, and it's her kind of like saying... she says that Minister Ellicott received a tape just like yours, and little did he know putting it in would activate the bomb. And like, she's one of her many mind games that Phoebe is playing. But I do enjoy the general use of cassette tapes in this. And you know, at the end of the episode, Mulder gets another cassette tape from her, and he decides not to listen to it as well.
He's learned his lesson not to play with fire.
Yeah, and it's just, again, like, there is something obviously very nostalgic about tapes. I think they've had a little bit of a resurgence in recent years, not to the extent that obviously vinyl has, but there is definitely a sense amongst sort of like the younger generations that tapes are a more authentic way of listening to music than MP3s or whatever.
Can you imagine? Like, I sort of understand the retro nostalgic desire around vinyl and everything like that, but and I don't know if it's just because cassette tapes were the thing that I first started listening to music on, but they just seem, I don't know, they don't have a sense of romanticism around them. They just seem like these dumb little things. They were fun. Like, I loved being able to record my own, like, radio shows onto them when I discovered that you could plug earphones into the mic jack and what, you know, and you could use it as a microphone. It worked the other way around too.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun with that. But I just can't imagine having that kind of romantic association with a cassette tape.
Well, I think you and I, we're probably... just slightly too young to have really had the whole mixtape thing, because like by the time we were making mixes for people, they were on CD. So like,
yes.
So I imagine people who are like 5 to 10 years older than us probably have a lot more affection for that because of the more analog quality of like having to actually like make copies of the different songs together and to try and line them up and things like that. So I can understand it like for people who had a closer like affection to it, and I do have a lot of nostalgia about very specific tapes that like my parents would play in the car when we'd go on long car journeys to Wales or whatever to visit family. Like they had a mix that was, I think, just like the hits of like 1990 or whatever,
olden times.
No, yeah, it was like, it was just a general one, and that's why for many years my favorite song was House of Fun by Madness, because it was on that on that tape, which is very funny. It's a very funny for like a five-year-old to be obsessed with a song about buying condoms from a pharmacist.
Is that what that song's about?
Yeah, this is a...
Oh, man, I'm going to have to go back and listen to that. I never realised.
Yeah, because he's like saying, we don't sell party gimmicks, go to the House of Fun. And it's all about, yeah, about going to the chemist to buy condoms and them saying, like, we don't sell that here. Yeah, but that's a great... I still love that song, but for like once I was slightly older and realised, oh, that's what it's about. I was like, oh, right, that's why my parents thought it was really funny that I was really into that song as a child. But yeah, like
the first music I bought myself was on cassette tape. Mm-hmm. It was Aqua Turn Back Time single, and also Cleopatra Coming At Ya.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first thing you bought music wise? Was that cassette or CD?
It was a CD. The first albums, the first things I ever bought on CD were, I believe it was Ash, the album Free All Angels, and Travis. The Invisible Band, I think, was the
classic
one.
Classic.
Yeah, which were both like solid albums. I did own some tapes because in my room I had my parents' old stereo stack that they didn't use anymore, so it had like all of their vinyl records and stuff in there, which I didn't learn how to use because the actual turntable was like on the top and I was too small to kind of like actually put the discs on, but I could reach the tape deck and things like that. And one of the tapes that they had was my mum had a copy of The Prodigy Experience, the first Prodigy album. So that was one I remember listening to quite
Blue
a lot.
Neck. Your parents ravers.
My mum, well, because obviously my parents ran pubs, and so they were always surrounded by people who were younger than them. So like in the early 90s, like they were in their early 30s, but they were obviously working with lots of people who were in their 20s. So my mum would often know about a lot of stuff that was going on in terms of music and film. Like she would go and watch Pulp Fiction and Trainspotting at the cinema with people who worked there. And she did once go to a rave to prove to the young people that she was working with that she could kind of keep up with them. And they did make her sneak in the drugs that they were all going to take. Not my mum, as she says she didn't take any of the drugs, but they had like, they had her like wearing, I think, a bracelet which had like the ecstasy on or whatever.
Oh my god! And yes, I'm sure your mum did not partake. That's wild.
Yeah, but they knew she wouldn't get checked because she was in her 30s and like there was no. So yeah, so she. I'm very fond of that story.
She was only in her 30s. It's not like she was like some granny.
Well, she was like, you know, she was like, she would have been like, I don't know, 33, two kids, running a pub.
We're 37. We're still young. Well, we could still go raving.
I know, but like, if you remember, like, when you were in your 20s, like, someone in their 30s seemed decrepit.
Yeah, well old, like, geriatric, like ancient.
I remember at a party when I was working at the showroom in Sheffield. It was a party, I think, after DocFest, the Sheffield Documentary Festival that happens every year. There were a bunch of us who were all like in our early 20s, and there was another guy there, Dave, who was one of the projectionists, and he was like a guy who was like had a very youthful spirit, but like he was obviously clearly older than all of us, and like they made me go up and ask him how old he was, and he said he was 34, and then we were like 34, and I feel bad about that to this day, sorry Dave forever. That reaction, but that was really like it did, like at the age of like, you know, 22, 23, like 34 seems like a real adult, you know. I think that's that's probably like the same. Until I think it's like Oscar Wilde had a quote which is like everyone's the same age once you hit 30.
And basically,
like, I think that is still very much true, because like, you know, now I work with people who are like in their 40s and 50s and whatever, and it's like it all feels like we're part of a similar sort of cohort, but then the people I work with who are like 28 or whatever, it's like they're fucking aliens,
so young and fresh with so much vitality and energy. Let me just suck that up. Big news from this week, which, you know, I failed to tell you at the start of this, Ed. I got ID'd buying Lemsip. And I did not have my ID on me. This was the same day that upon opening the door to a friend, they were like, oh my God, are you okay? You look so pale and tired. So I don't know if this woman was, the person who ID'd me in the shop was just feeling really sorry for me or what. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to be over 16 to buy Lemsip. So clearly, you know, I'm a very youthful 37.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've been working the moisturizer and taking care.
Get those peptides on the skin, you know.
Yeah, I can't remember when the last time I was ID'd. I feel like I was still getting ID'd until I was like 31 or 32, buying drinks. Because I think up until then I still looked quite youthful. And I think I look younger than 37 for the most part.
I mean, I think I do too, yeah, but I just think that's wishful thinking.
Yeah,
I don't think you look 37 either, Ed, but at this point, I'm not a good judge. who can tell?
But yeah, definitely if I was like ever clean shaven, and I would try and buy a drink over here, I would get ID'd like 4 out of 5 times. But it hasn't happened since. Since the pandemic, so I don't know if that just aged me.
We all had a rough time, Ed. Yeah. Like, we've all aged a bit. I mean, we have, literally, because it was like
4 years.
4 years ago now.
Yeah.
Literally and spiritually. Anyway, cassette tapes were a long time ago.
Yeah. One of the things that also leapt out to me in this one I thought was interesting was when they're listening to the tape that Phoebe made, and they mention that it's talking about, you know, Minister Ellicott being blown up by a thing. I thought that was really interesting because it seems to be an allusion to the death of Ian Gough, who was a conservative politician who was killed by the IRA, or maybe the PIRA, I forget, some part of the IRA, in 1990. He was killed in a car bomb. I thought it was interesting that it's an allusion to the real world, but also, like, apparently not a real person. And I was just thinking that because just yesterday, on the day we're recording this, I was listening to our episode on space, which people would have heard by now, in which, you know, like, one of the things about the episode that really struck a wrong note for me was them, like, evoking, directly referencing the Challenger disaster. Whereas here, it's kind of like, okay, they're kind of alluding to real things that happened where politicians were killed in car bombs, but they're not, like, naming a real one. So at least they are showing a little bit of tact there by not actually doing that.
And it could have gone a different way, I guess, this episode, because apparently whilst Chris Carter was writing the script for this, Malibu was on fire. You know, there was, I guess it was the summer in California, and there were wildfires and everything. So you could imagine a different variation of this where someone's not necessarily just targeting, say, aristocrats, but they're going around just causing havoc, setting wildfires. But, I mean, there's nothing paranormal about that. But, yeah, apparently the fire started after he had the idea and he'd started scripting. So it wasn't like those fires inspired this. It just happened to be happening at the time. So, and obviously now it happens all the time.
Yeah. It's like, I'm still slowly working my way through Ulysses and also the explanatory notes. And there's a whole chapter in it where these characters are debating, like, Shakespeare and, like, the authorship of his plays and, like, if there's any kind of, like, deeper meaning to his later ones, if they relate to real events from his life. And in the explanatory notes, there's a whole thing in there where apparently a decent amount of Shakespearean scholarship is devoted to trying to figure out when he wrote one of the sonnets that he wrote, because the sonnet references an earthquake. And so a lot of it is trying to think, like, oh, could he have written this on the day that an earthquake happened? Because it's kind of an interesting thing since the reference. And even reading that, I was just kind of thinking, I don't know, could have just thought, I'll write about an earthquake. He doesn't necessarily have to have actually experienced one, or he could have, like, read about an earthquake in a book, which...
Yeah.
But yeah, that's just what that reminded me of. Like, you know, I'm sure he had seen other fires. Like, it's not like California is a stranger to fires in the summertime. Certainly not nowadays, but even back then, it was, you know, they've had fires here for a long time.
Tell you something that bugged John mainly. I'm kind of bugged about it now also with him going on about it, but...
I like to imagine this was the main topic of conversation in your 7 hours in the car.
Yes, it pretty much was. You know, a good half of that, you know, 3.5 of those hours was pretty much focused on solely trying to figure this out. So towards the start of the episode, when the Marsdens are going into their vacation, their holiday home, and Cecil, who is pretending to be the caretaker, Bob, comes to say hello, and just after he says goodbye and whatever, they're stood on the stairs and they're looking at this portrait and the guy's like, oh, it's like the spitting image of you, and then there's no relevance to that whatsoever later or at all. It's just, yes, the blonde woman in the portrait kind of looks like that woman, so what? John's like, it's like Chekhov's gun, but the gun never gets fired.
That is very funny. But the implication that I got from it was that Cecil had painted it himself. And
oh, do you think?
And it's meant to be...
That didn't occur to us.
That's meant to be an indication of his obsession with her.
Obsession, yes.
Although that then raises further questions of like, how long has he been following these people that he knew they would be going to this house and that he would have time to kill the caretaker and paint this painting? But I guess if the implication is that he killed Bob some time ago and he has been the one like corresponding with them, then I guess he would have had a few weeks. So that would make sense. But yeah, like that, then you're getting into like the practicalities of the episode, and that's not usually a great decision in fiction to kind of like really nitpick any of it. But that was the implication that I got, was that Bob must have, Cecil must have painted it himself and like had put it in there as a sign of his obsession with her.
Yeah. So the other thing we were discussing and trying to figure out was, so when Scully looks into the identity of people and they find that there's this one crossover between the staff of all these different people, and it's Cecil Lively, and it's, and happens to be someone who supposedly died in a fire in 1971 in London, and then also the name of someone who was a child that was killed during some sort of satanic sacrifice ritual thing back in the day. And what we were trying to figure out is, are they suggesting there that he's simply using the identity of Cecil Lively, taking it on as his own? Or is he actually Cecil Lively? Because we see he survives going up in flames at the end. So maybe they just thought that the Cecil Lively that died in the fire in 1971 died but didn't find a body, but actually, yeah, like what do you reckon is the case there?
To me, the one that would make the most sense in terms of like him doing this over and over would be if he just takes on the identity of Cecil Lively, like presumably after, if he had like succeeded in killing like the Marsons and then disappearing, he would then just go around as Bob for a bit and then take on a new identity. But the idea of like, you know, like a child dying in a satanic ritual but then not finding a body, that suggests that he is Cecil, and he's just been using that name up until this point, and then coming over to America, adopting the name Bob to kind of like blend in. That probably is more just like, okay, that's the name he's using for this particular job, this particular obsession, and then, you know, he would go back to the UK and be Cecil again.
Yeah.
Or Cecil.
So it's just a coincidence that Cecil died in a fire.
Yeah.
And that's a coincidental link.
Yeah, maybe. The other thing we didn't... another kind of scene that I thought was really good in this, we haven't really talked about much, is there's a few scenes of Bob hanging around, / Cecil, hanging around with the two young children of the Marsdens. Mm-hmm. And there's a sequence where he's like talking to them about cigarettes and trying to get them to take one of them, which I thought was extremely unsettling and very creepy.
Yeah.
And again, it really plays on Mark Shepherd's like particular brand of like sinister charisma, where on the one hand, you could understand why these kids would be drawn to him, because he's kind of like, he's being silly and he's kind of like playing around.
You guys ever smoked a cigarette?
No, they're bad for you.
Would you like to take a puff, Michael?
Nah.
Make a man out of you?
I don't want to.
Why don't you hold one for me?
But also, there's this underlying threat to him, which I think is probably just the case of any instance where, like, a man in his 30s is, like, hanging around with two children that aren't...
Getting them to smoke, because smokers are jokers, so those kids were well smart saying no. I was so pleased they said no.
They know what's up. But
they do. Clever boys.
That scene was really, really good. And I think in terms of, like, balancing out his character and not making him, like, too charismatic and compelling, you know, that's a good thing to have him. Oh, right, yeah, he wants to kill these kids, probably. Or at the very least, he means them ill. So, so that was well done.
Yeah, very well done.
Oh, and we mentioned it a little bit there. Like, there's an allusion to a youthful indiscretion on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's grave. And in general, there's like a lot of references to Sherlock Holmes in this episode. It seems to be a shared interest between Phoebe and Mulder. They describe the mystery as a three-pipe problem, which is a kind of a reference from the books, I believe. The idea, if it's something that's really taxing Sherlock Holmes, he would go through multiple pipes trying to figure it out. At one point, when Mulder returns to the office, Scully says, "So Sherlock, is the game afoot?" And just kind of like making fun of him in the way that she does throughout the episode. So I, as someone who has read all of the Sherlock Holmes books like many years ago, I enjoyed that. I always enjoy when they give people a fascination with Sherlock Holmes as a character trait, because, I don't know, it seems to be somewhat revealing of someone if they're like drawn to Sherlock Holmes in that way. Like they become methodical and obsessive. And although the Mulder-Scully dynamic is not exactly the same as like Holmes and Watson, I think there are interesting parallels that you can kind of like draw in the fact that one of them is actually a doctor.
I'm kind of surprised that Sherlock Holmes doesn't come up more often as a reference, you know, given that they're trying to unpick mysteries and that whole dynamic between those two. Mulder is a kind of obsessive person trying to figure out the mysteries. I just liked how, you know, Scully's asking about the joke and Mulder responds saying it's a very private joke, and given that later on they then allude to shagging or doing whatever it is they do on Arthur Conan Doyle's grave, it's just like, yeah, I think that's pretty much the most private of jokes that you could have.
And then the other, like, last the note I had, I thought it was very funny when at the end of the episode there, Mulder's in his office, and then off screen you hear an English accent saying, "You're going to take me to lunch," and then real it's Scully just doing an impression. Scully, yeah. Which I thought was very funny. This episode is a real great showcase for the lighter side of Dana Scully, and like Gillian Anderson getting to have fun as kind of like the observer to Mulder making terrible decisions. And she's very good at that.
It's a theme. One thing I did pick up on this, and I'm going to assume that this is the sort of episode where people would be looking at, you know, Mulder and Scully's relationship, being like, you know, what does this say about the relationship? Obviously, I'm coming from the point of like, I just don't think they're interested in each other that way. And, you know, confirmation bias, the scene where Phoebe's coming up the stairs in her ball gown in the hotel and Mulder sees her and, you know, he can tell, he's like, "Oh yeah, that's nice." I'm like, he's never looked at Scully that way. I just don't think he's interested her in that way. And, you know, Scully rolling her eyes at Mulder and Phoebe is less because she's jealous and more just because he's being a bloody idiot and he's meant to be working. That's all I will say on that. Another reason why we shouldn't like Cecil is because he kicks the dog.
Yes, as well. That's very upsetting. Early on, when the dog is uncovering the hand, the partially buried hand of the real Bob the caretaker, and then, he boots it like Jack Black in Anchorman. a very easy... obviously, kind of like the opposite of Save the Cat, instead of like a way of making the audience sympathize from someone, immediately make them hate them by saying like, "Oh, I kicked a tiny, adorable little terrier."
Yeah, exactly. Evil man.
And the last thing I have here, the opening scene, obviously it's probably shot somewhere in Vancouver, but it's meant to take place in England, a place called Bosham, which is in West Sussex. I looked it up to see if it's a real place, because you never know sometimes. Bosham does sound like a fake name that you would come up with for an English town. But it is real. Looked up. Seems quite nice. If anyone's looking for a coastal day out, go to Bosham in West Sussex.
Yeah. It's funny, despite, I'm sure, some American and Canadian, North American architecture trying to redo English architecture and things like that, it never really looks like England. If it weren't for the fact that you've got the little subtitle down at the bottom that tells you where we are and they have ridiculous English accents, there's just something about when they try to depict English places that are clearly filmed in America, like, it's just really obvious and I can never put my finger on it.
It's just
wrong. It's like Uncanny Valley, but for houses.
Yeah, it's definitely like one of those things where you just see a location, you think, there's just like not, there's no houses in England that seem that kind of like that modern and planned, because so much of it is just kind of like stuff that's thrown up over the years wherever there's space. There isn't that same sort of neatness, even in suburbs in England. Like, there's never really that kind of like space and neatness that you get in America and Canada. I also thought it was funny when they say Bosham, they specifically say Bosham, 70 miles south of London. It's kind of like, okay, that's one for the Americans. It's just like, you can't just say that it's Bosham in England. It's got to be, where does this relate to London?
Yeah, because everyone knows where London is on the map of Great Britain.
Yeah. Sort of down the bottom there.
Somewhere along the Thames.
Yeah, if you hit on the EastEnders logo, you were in the right place. So what would you rate this episode, Michaela?
I think I'm gonna give this one an 8.5. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it, but I also sort of think maybe I get a little dazed by the fun of the fire when maybe it isn't that, I don't know. I like, there's a lot about it that isn't bad, but I can also recognize there's a lot about it that isn't quite amazing as well. But I'm just, it's a lot of fun and I really love it for all the fire spectacle, basically. How about you?
I'm going to give it an 8, I think. My rating, so basically there's two ratings in my head. There's the one from immediately after I watched the episode, which it would be 8. I really enjoyed it. There's a few kind of like, I think, bits of the writing that are a little obvious, you know, the Mulder's fear of fire and all that sort of stuff. But for the most part, it's just like a really fun, enjoyable episode of television. But then to offer people a peek behind the curtain a little bit here, we're recording two episodes today. And so I had to watch this episode and then the next episode. And the next episode is so good that then when I kind of think back on this episode, it kind of pales in comparison. So part of it is just kind of like, you know, initially it was 8, then it gets knocked down to a 7 because I think, well, it's not as good as Beyond the Sea, is it? But
that's true. I'm trying to look at this like independently and also in terms of my enjoyment, and thus why I'm like, no, I know this isn't as good as clearly that episode and lots of other episodes, but I really bloody enjoyed it.
Yeah, so that's why the final rating for me is an 8, because that's the fairer rating of like immediately after watching it thinking, yep, yeah, that's a really good time. Try and think of it not in terms of comparison to other episodes. It knows what it's trying to do and I think it does really well.
Okay, fine. You've talked me into getting into consensus. I'll also final rating give it an 8 too. The 0.5 was maybe just being a bit too generous.
Thank you everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, rate us, review us, recommend us to your friends. It's the best way to help us grow our audience. You can also find us on Twitter where we are at @thefireroompod, and you can email us at thefireroompod@gmail.com. If you have any cassette stories, fire stories, if they're not too terrifying, I don't know.
Yeah, if you haven't committed any crimes, I'm sure you can tell us about them.
Our music is by Leonel Cassio. And we'll be back next time with the aforementioned Beyond the Sea. A very, very good episode of television.
Stunner.
But until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. The paranormal is real.
Paranormal is real. Is it?